I don't want to be a soldier. I don't want to kill and maim another mother's son or daughter. Imperial war is a dirty game. I don't want,
I don't want
to be a soldier,
be a soldier,
steal some other people's wealth, invade their homes and their nation. This is how I've always felt. I call upon the world's millions. No more war in our name. Stop this madness. Stop the killing. Stop the suffering and the pain.
I don't want
to be a soldier.
Murdered
children in foreign lands, bomb and terrorize all those families. So for peace, I'll take my stand. Call upon the world's millions. No more war in our name. Stop this madness. Stop the killing. Stop the suffering and the pain. So
I don't want
to be a soldier.
I don't want
to kill and maim,
to kill and maim
another mother's
son or daughter.
George Bush's war is a dirty game. George Bush's war is a dirty game.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program starts out with Rosemary Gibson, who talks about her book, Medicare Meltdown, How Wall Street and Washington Are Ruining Medicare and How to Fix It, in which she looks at the future of Medicare. Rosemary Gibson was a senior program officer at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. She has led national initiatives to improve the quality of America's healthcare and reduce the harm from medical errors. And then after that, Chris Dodd's FISA speech. Chris Dodd is an American lawyer and lobbyist and U.S. Senator representing Connecticut. He served in Congress from 1975 to 2011. And FISA is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which regulates the physical and electronic surveillance and collection of intelligence within the U.S. by the government.
Next, Rosemary Gibson presents her thoughts on the future of Medicare and argues that the healthcare industry, more so than the public, is dependent on the $600 billion of annual Medicare spending.
For today is Medicare and where we're headed and what it means for you and your patients. Today in Washington, D.C., the Obama administration is preparing to release its federal budget proposal tomorrow that will have changes proposed for the Medicare program. You might think, well, I'm not over 65, although some in the room may be over 65. What does Medicare have to do with me? In fact, Medicare has a role in the lives of all of us, including residents. The President's proposal will be yet another ongoing salvo in the debate over the future of Medicare. Both Democrats and Republicans have proposed raising Medicare's eligibility age from 65 to 67. Others have proposed that seniors buy into the health exchanges that will be coming online during the health care reform. And others have proposed eliminating fee-for-service medicine in Medicare entirely and having everyone enroll in a private insurance plan. These are proposals on the table, hotly debated. I wrote the book Medicare Meltdown to help the public understand what's going on behind the scenes, the debates that don't show up in the mainstream media. Here's why Medicare matters. There's 50 million people who are covered by Medicare for their health insurance today. This hospital and every hospital depends on Medicare for a substantial portion of its revenues. For those of you who are residents in training, you may not know that Medicare pays your residency stipends. It pays for faculty salaries. It makes residency training possible. All of us pay for Medicare, and we'll all be covered by it, so it's something that we all have in common in the United States. Here's a graph from the Congressional Budget Office from a couple of years ago, 2007. That projected using historical trends in Medicare spending, where are we headed? In 1996, about 2.5% of our gross domestic product was spent just on Medicare. And if those historical trends continue, by 2082, we'll be spending 25% of the country's GDP just on Medicare. From that same Congressional Budget Office report, and by the way, these graphs were tucked away in an appendix on the last page, and haven't seen much light of day, but I think it's important for the public to know this. For total health care spending, if historical trends continue, by 2082 as a country we'll be spending 99% of our GDP just on health care. And so this is why there's urgency around Medicare and health care to find some mechanism to limit how much we spend. And that's the purpose of the book Medicare Meltdown. And it focuses on the business aspects of Medicare, because not only is Medicare an entitlement for seniors, it is also big business. And that's a powerful force driving the trajectory of health care and the kinds of care that patients receive. In that respect, it shines a light on aspects of Medicare that we don't read much about. In fact, more of the news that I read now is on Bloomberg News and other business news to find out what's happening in health care. The book examines where the money comes from to pay for Medicare, where it goes, who's getting it, and what they're doing with it. And I believe that the public has a right to this information because we're all paying for it from our paychecks, and for those who are on Medicare, from the premiums that they pay. And once again, we look at the outsized influence of the healthcare industry on Medicare. It is indeed an entitlement for seniors. It's also the largest federal entitlement-based industry in the United States. Let's talk about the size of Medicare. If Medicare were a country, it would be the 20th largest economy in the world. It's enormous. Medicare spends $560 billion in 2011 for 50 million people. And this dollar amount is more than the size of Sweden's economy and double the size of Ireland's economy. Just Medicare as one portion of health care. So no matter whether Democrats or Republicans prevail in shaping Medicare's future, it turns out Medicare will become very crowded by 2030. Every day, 10,000 boomers sign up for Medicare, and 33 million more people will be on Medicare by 2030. This number is equivalent to adding the current combined populations of Austria, Hong Kong, Israel, and Switzerland to the Medicare program. Hospitals, doctors, nurses, and the entire delivery system are and will be under increasing pressure to take care of everyone. And are we ready for it? Medicare pays for residency training, pays for almost all of it. It pays the cost of your stipends. It pays for teaching physician salaries and other expenses. And with pressure on the federal debt, graduate medical education is certainly under the budget microscope, like many other things. Your residency training is funded by $9.5 million in funding from Medicare, $5.8 billion from Medicaid. That's a combination of state and federal money. And once again, it's being closely scrutinized. I'd like to do three things this morning. Identify where the money from Medicare goes and how it's being used. Second, discuss the impact of the incentives in the program and what it means for patients and their physicians, meaning many of you. And I'd like to make the case for limits on Medicare spending to sustain this program for current and future generations. For those of you who are young people in this room, you want to count on Medicare and ensure that it's there for you. So first, where does Medicare's money come from and how is it being used? In 1965, Medicare laid the foundation for the establishment and growth of the healthcare industry. And the past 50 years have seen an explosion in biomedical advances, dramatic innovation in therapies and surgical procedures, and tremendous successes in the management of diseases that were once fatal. And Medicare has also changed the U.S. economy in unprecedented ways. Here's two graphs on international spending on healthcare from 1980 to 2007. And I'll just direct your attention to the graph on the right. These are total health expenditures as a percentage of GDP for a number of developed countries. And you'll see that the United States, it's the black line, is way out ahead of all the other countries. But once again, this has enabled innovation and the application of wonderful healthcare services to millions of Americans who've benefited. Who pays for Medicare? It turns out we all pay for Medicare. All of us who work pay for Medicare from a 2.9% payroll tax deducted from your paychecks. If you look at your pay stub, you'll see this amount deducted every paycheck. You also pay for Medicare from your federal income tax that you pay. And seniors over 65 pay premiums and co-payments. This was a reader comment to the New York Times in response to a column written by Paul Krugman. The reader wrote, "In my opinion, federal programs such as Medicare that are supported by participants' insurance premiums and not by federal general tax revenues should not be a political football in Congress. While these programs need to be reviewed for their future sustainability, they have not contributed to the federal debt." In fact, that's a myth. Here's the truth. 44% of Medicare spending is paid for by federal income tax revenue. So Medicare does contribute to the federal debt because the federal government does not collect sufficient money from the taxes and other sources to pay all of its Medicare bills and has to borrow money and pays interest on that debt. So yes, Medicare does add to the federal debt. This means that when bills are sent to Medicare, the federal government doesn't have the money to pay all of them, and it borrows money from places like China. And the U.S. federal debt exceeds $16 trillion, and that's an enormous sum of money and growing.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Watch your step, Mr. D. President call your enemy. Pick you up in dark of night, then you will be out of sight. Bout a mecca, Mr. L, and your rides can go to hell. Bring you inside for a chat, disappearing just like that. Where'd they find you, Mr. N? Over in Afghanistan. You're rotten Cuba, yes indeed. No sounds to hear, no sights to see. Mr. Q, what did you do? You spoke your mind now, didn't you? They did a tap dance on your phone. Now you're dancing all alone. When they came for all these men, why well, I said nothing, nothing then. Then when they came for me, there was no one left to see. They wave the flag and they say we're free. But that's for those who do agree. Watch your step, Mr. D. You are now the enemy. You want to speak out on TV? Well, that's a good one, Mr. C. The station owner, they say no. They got a license, don't you know? You plan for marching, Mr. T. Well, that's bad for security. The Bill of Rights was fine before, but it's not for this kind of war. You went down to the library. Why didn't you, Mr. G? Your card was lifted by the Fed. I wanna see just what you read. You sent money, Mr. B, to the foreign charity. They say it went to make a bomb. Now it's you who come to harm. The Congress did what it was told, but you know they're bought and sold. The courts, they sat upon their hands. Who are they to take a stand? The press, it seems, just didn't care. They're covering Joe Millionaire. Watch your step, Mr. D. You are now the enemy.
Most people think of Medicare as an entitlement for seniors, and it is. But Medicare is also big business. Healthcare businesses and facilities rely on Medicare for $560 billion in annual revenue, the amount that Medicare spends in a year. In 1965, there were no healthcare companies listed on the Fortune 100 list. Today, there are 15 healthcare companies that are on that list and are dependent on Medicare and other sources of funding for their revenue. And these interests have a powerful influence on the debate over the future of Medicare. There's a debate, for example, over whether Medicare should be privatized to move from fee-for-service to private health insurance plans. Already, Medicare is partially privatized. Most people don't know that. 25% of seniors, perhaps some people in this room, belong to a private health insurance plan for their Medicare coverage. In Medicare meltdown, I predict that this trend will continue. Health insurance companies certainly want as customers as many as they can, and certainly the 33 million new baby boomers who will be enrolling in Medicare between now and 2030. Let's talk a little bit about Medicare waste. The Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Sciences estimated last September that 30% of all healthcare spending, including Medicare, is lost to waste. That might be from administrative costs. We were talking earlier about the cost of billing. It's an enormous sum of money, unnecessary treatment, and, of course, fraud and abuse. This amount of Medicare waste, believe it or not, $170 billion, is the size of the entire economy of New Zealand. And all of us are paying for it, from our paychecks, for our premiums. Here's a narrative from a very conscientious doctor who tried to cut Medicare and other healthcare waste in his hospital. He's a very dedicated pediatric neurosurgeon that I've had the pleasure of knowing from my work in healthcare. He heard a talk in Washington about how physicians should be good stewards of healthcare resources. So he took that missive seriously, went back to his hospital, and asked the CFO to bring someone in to help tell him how much all the supplies in his operating room cost, because he never knew. So the CFO sent over a financial person, and they went through all the inventory in this surgeon's OR. And what they found was $700,000 worth of supplies. 10% had expired and had to be thrown away. $70,000 worth thrown away. And he said, I only needed $295,000 of that $700,000 worth of supplies that were needed. He was astonished. He had no clue. He said, the sutures that the hospital was buying, I could buy them for $35,000 less. And so he encouraged the hospital to buy the less costly product. He was very eager to tell the CEO that he thought he'd discovered a gold mine for the hospital, that this would be a way that the hospital could save lots of money and keep that money for patient care and other things. So he set up a meeting with the CEO, and he did a back-of-the-envelope calculation about the millions of dollars that he believed the hospital could save if they could purchase supplies and equipment much more cheaply. And it turns out he hit what I call the brick ceiling. The non-competitive, non-transparent, quote, market for hospital supplies and equipment. This is a $200 billion market that accounts for 8% of total healthcare spending. And in the 1980s, this market received an anti-kickback exemption from Congress. What started out as a Costco model, a model where people can buy volumes of products and services less expensively has turned into one of the most expensive ways possible to purchase anything on the planet. Recently, I asked him how things were going, and he said, I went to buy a piece of ultrasound equipment, and I went online and found it for a certain price, and I realized that the hospital had to purchase it through its own channels and paid 100 times much what he could find on the internet for that piece of equipment. I'd like to discuss the impact of the financial incentives in the Medicare program and what it means for patients and their physicians. We are in medicine, as I'm sure that you see here at St. Peter's and every hospital around the country, in the age of, quote, productivity. Researchers at the Mayo Clinic surveyed more than 7,000 doctors, and 46% had at least one symptom of burnout. Demands for more productivity, quotas, are one factor in doctor burnout and in unhappiness. Some of you may have seen the 60 Minutes segment that aired a number of months ago. These are emergency room physicians who appeared. They were employees of a hospital based in Arkansas, a for-profit institution. And they were expressing deep concern about the quotas they had to admit patients from the ER into the hospital to keep the revenue growing. 60 Minutes reported on this hospital system that allegedly pressured its ER doctors to admit more and more patients, regardless of medical need, in order to increase revenues. The ER director reportedly told the ER doctors, I've been told to replace you if you don't meet your numbers. For example, when physicians thought it appropriate to send a patient home from the ER, the hospital computer system would send a message questioning the physician's decision.
Coming up next, the Pearl Harbor speech delivered December 8, 1941 by Franklin Delano Roosevelt. FDR was the 32nd President of the United States.
Senators and representatives, I have the distinguished honor of presenting the President of the United States.
Mr. Vice President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate, of the House of Representatives, yesterday, December 7, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation, and at the solicitation of Japan, was still in conversation with its government and its emperor, looking toward the maintenance of peace in the Pacific. Indeed, 1 hour after Japanese air squadrons had commenced bombing in the American island of Oahu, the Japanese ambassador to the United States and his colleague delivered to our Secretary of State a formal reply to a recent American message. And while this reply stated that it seemed useless to continue the existing diplomatic negotiations, it contained no threat or hint of war or of armed attack. It will be recorded that the distance of Hawaii from Japan makes it obvious that the attack was deliberately planned many days or even weeks ago. During the intervening time, the Japanese government has deliberately sought to deceive the United States by false statements and expressions of hope for continued peace. The attack yesterday on the Hawaiian Islands has caused severe damage to American naval and military forces. I regret to tell you that very many American lives have been lost. In addition, American ships have been reported torpedoed on the high seas between San Francisco and Honolulu. Yesterday, the Japanese government also launched an attack against Malaya. Last night, Japanese forces attacked Hong Kong. Last night, Japanese forces attacked Guam. Last night, Japanese forces attacked the Philippine Islands. Last night, the Japanese attacked Wake Island. And this morning, the Japanese attacked Midway Island. Japan has therefore undertaken a surprise offensive extending throughout the Pacific area. The facts of yesterday and today speak for themselves. The people of the United States have already formed their opinions and well understand the implications to the very life and safety of our nation. as Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy, I have directed that all measures be taken for our defense. But always will our whole nation remember the character of the onslaught against us. No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory. I believe that I interpret the will of the Congress and of the people when I assert that we will not only defend ourselves to the uttermost, but will make it very certain that this form of treachery shall never again endanger us. Hostilities exist. There is no blinking at the fact that our people, our territory, and our interests are in grave danger. With confidence in our armed forces, with the unbounding determination of our people, we will gain the inevitable triumph, so help us God. I ask that the Congress declare that since the unprovoked and dastardly attack by Japan on Sunday, December 7, 1941, a state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire.
And now for something completely different.